when it comes to immortality, we see ourselves as one link in an unbroken chain, starting with all of our ancestors before us, and then hopefully continuing with our descendants.
This is Simone Collins.
And we also see immortality as participating in that unbroken chain of humanity by having kids and raising them in a way where hopefully they will have kids to not be the end of that generation.
Simone is a pronatalist. In broad strokes, that means she supports practices and policies that encourage childbearing. Pronatalism has cropped up at different points in history among various social groups, whether for the purpose of making more citizens or settlers, or accessing a bigger pool of labor. It's often tied to economic concerns, but it's rife with symbolic anxieties as well, because implicitly, pronatalism advocates for more childbearing among certain groups of people. Simone and her husband, Malcolm Collins, are among a new generation of pronatalists. They're a white couple in their mid-30s who live in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania. Both have short-cropped hair and wear thick, black-rimmed glasses. In media photos, their unvarying look is one of consuming joy. The bright smiles are somewhat at odds with their grinding preoccupation. They see society as teetering on the brink. They're not trying to rear soldiers or farmhands. They're breeding to offset the collapse of civilization.
I don't know how to tell my kids or my grandkids that in this last era of luxury, I indolently sat on my butt, indulging in the last vestiges of opulent civilization, instead of acquiring resources and building a movement.
Simone and Malcolm run pronatalist.org, which they say is the first pronatalist foundation in the world. They view the falling birth rates in developed countries as a sign of broader societal decline.
Like, it's just such an obvious problem. Like, the data is screaming, the world's leading to likely an economic disaster. Yeah, a lot of cultures are going to go extinct. Our species is going to go through sort of a mass cultural extinction, and humanity is going to homogenize, both ethnically and culturally.
They're pretty candid about how people tend to view their position. But they say they're just reacting to the data.
And you start talking about this stuff, and now I know why nobody was talking about it, because you immediately get called like a racist and a Nazi. Anyway, it was also something we began to think a lot about, right? Like, how do you actually solve this problem?
So they're trying, humbly, to change the course of Western culture. They want to boost the birth rate among the wealthy and the educated. And doing that means tinkering with values and meaning.
Okay, so I know this sounds crazy, but yes, my wife and I did craft a religion for our kids. We call it descendant worship. In the same way that some families look at their ancestors in ancestor worship, they see sort of their ancestors as collectively sort of deity-like and better than them. That's the way we see our kids. They are collectively better than us. And we can create the divine by giving them the best shot possible and ensuring that they do better than we did and better than we can conceive of doing.
What we tell our kids is this. What do you think our descendants in 1,000 years are going to be like? Are they going to be more like us, or are they going to be more like what we would conceive of as a god? And if you think back to, like, if we showed up in some kind of time machine and stood before, with all of our technology and all of our knowledge, someone from 1,000 years ago, they would probably think that we are closer to a god than to what they personally are.
The Collinses are suggesting that our distant descendants might be so advanced that they can travel through time.
And it's a very fun thing to think about. If we believe that future descendants can be godlike in their powers, you might be more interested in thinking about creating a future in which your future descendants reward you when you do the right thing.
And the right thing, according to Simone and Malcolm, is to be fruitful and multiply. And convince their children and their children's children to do the same.
If we have 8 kids and they have 8 kids, and you do that for just 11 generations, we'd have more descendants than there are people on Earth today.
I'm Catherine Rowland, and from Sony Music Entertainment, this is Seeking. So far this season, we've been looking into radical longevity and the quest to live forever. Today, we're looking at a more old-fashioned idea, your children as your legacy. They're your bridge to the future and your monuments to all of your imagined successors. For Simone and Malcolm Collins, this idea has been updated, quantified, and filtered through new technophile dreams. And they're hardly alone. A new reproductive ideology is circling through Silicon Valley and among the tech elite. Even if our fragile lives peter out, we can live on eternally through our heirs. Oh, and in the process, save the world.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
When I first heard about Simone and Malcolm, I immediately thought of Quiverful. That's a Christian movement based on creating large families to spread the word of God. But Simone and Malcolm don't identify with Judeo-Christian traditions. In addition to being descendant worshipers, they're secular Calvinists, atheists, that is, who also believe in predestination in a strict moral order. Simone was not raised to be a mother of generations that could overtake the world. She grew up an only child in a hippie household in California. But her rebellion skewed conservative. She was studious, focused. She attended George Washington University. After she graduated valedictorian with a degree in business and marketing, she had no interest in becoming a mother.
If someone offered to hand me their baby, I would say, no, thank you.
But in 2012, she decided that she would go through the paces of love and romance.
I had decided when I hit age 24 that I was going to fall in love and have my heart broken because up to that point, I'd never dated before, had never had sex, had only kissed one person before, just had zero interest in dating.
She did what many earnest love seekers did at the time. She put up a profile on OkCupid. One that she thought was perfectly calibrated to attract someone who was as extremely online as she was. But when the suitors started pouring in, she got cold feet. So she decided to gamify the whole process.
I had created a competitive dating ring at my office among other young people my age who were also dating, where we, like, you know, 1 point for getting someone to go on a first date with you, like 3 points for a first date that turns into a second date. It was on the whiteboard. This is a huge HR violation, but God bless startups. There is no HR department.
Simone came up with a 50-point scale. The higher the score, the greater the catch. But most of her dates weren't ranking very high. That is, until she matched with this young guy. He was fresh from an undergraduate degree in neuroscience and was on his way to the Stanford School of Business.
So on the first date, she was looking to fall in love and have her heart broken, and I was looking for a wife, and I was like, oh, this is really convenient, because I was gonna start at Stanford for my MBA in about 6 months, and I was like, so I can date you in the interim, because there's this large pool of pre-vetted candidates there where I'm definitely gonna find my wife.
That might sound pretty blunt, but Simone, she was smitten from the start.
I just thought he was the best. I was completely head over heels. He was also extremely honest and upfront, saying on our first date, basically, that he expected to find a wife. I was not going to be that wife, but that he still found me interesting. Now knowing that I'm autistic and that I can't really read social cues, I found that such a relief. It was such an immense relief to meet someone who said what they wanted, who was very honest, and who also laid out his entire life plan.
The temporary romance quickly blossomed into a full-time commitment. Malcolm tells me he fell for Simone's voracious quest for knowledge, as he puts it. He admired what he saw as her drive for continual self-improvement. And along the way, he was able to redirect her priorities from never having kids to being a mother of ideally a dozen children.
The agreement was, if I didn't want to, I wouldn't have to do anything with them. I wouldn't have to, you know, stop anything to raise them.
After a year and a half, Malcolm asked Simone to marry him. It was after they married that Malcolm started to seriously mull the decline of civilization.
So I was working as a venture capitalist in South Korea. And as a venture capitalist, you know, when you're making investments in companies, you need to predict where the economy is going to be in 50 years, 100 years.
This was in 2015. The year before, the South Korean legislature had released data showing that its fertility rate had dropped to a record low. Just 1.19 children per woman. The study warned that at this rate, the country faced, quote, natural extinction. Despite the dire warning, the country's fertility rate has declined further to around 0.8 children per woman. No other developed democratic nation has seen its birth rate slip so low. But what's happening in South Korea parallels trends taking place around the world.
South Korea's population continues to shrink as the number of births goes down and deaths go up.
From Sicily, demographers warn that the shrinking population could drag the country into an unprecedented economic crisis.
The U.S. fertility rate has plummeted for the past 15 years. And so the problem here is that now we are at a level of fertility in this country that is below replacement level.
The numbers are incontestable. What's open to debate is what they mean. To some, it's good news. If women aren't relentlessly tethered to reproduction, they can pursue degrees and careers and make economic gains. And with less bodies around, resources get freed up for things like education and housing and nutrition. The argument follows that children then receive better care and attention and face brighter prospects as they grow older. And of course, it means less strain on the environment.
Let's take a break from bashing millennials for their safe spaces, man buns, and avocado toast, and give them credit for doing something right, having less sex than other generations, and so less babies, which is good for the planet.
But to others, it spells disaster. Over the past two centuries, the world's population has exploded. From around 900 million people in 1800 to nearly 8 billion today. And our dominant global systems, capitalism, consumerism, are based on assumptions of ever-growing demand. So if the birth rate starts to drop, the whole social order comes under threat. It's something plenty of public figures are talking about, like the comedian Russell Brand, as well as billionaires like Jack Ma and Elon Musk.
Birth rates are declining, and in less than 100 years, countries like Spain and Japan could have half as many people as they have now. How can that be a right-wing or left-wing talking point? What's going on?
Most people think we have, like, too many people on the planet, but actually, this is an outdated view.
More after the break.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Elon Musk has 10 children. and is among the most outspoken proponents of the idea that not having enough babies is the biggest threat to our planet. Here he is talking about it at the Wall Street Journal's CEO Council Summit.
I can't emphasize this enough. There are not enough people. And I think one of the biggest risks to civilization is the low birth rate and the rapidly declining birth rate. If people don't have more children, civilization is going to crumble.
The rate of global population growth has slowed, but it's hardly sluggish. We've added 1 billion people to the planet since 2010. But longer-term predictions for whether these trends continue are unreliable. The UN projects that the global population will reach 10 billion by 2050, and thereafter, either continue to rise or start to fall. The UN puts the matter clearly. Quote, "The size of the world's population is almost certain to rise over the next several decades, as is the degree of uncertainty associated with those projections." To me, it seems like a wild flight of imagination to think that current population trends will remain stable over centuries. Between climate change, new wars, new religions, new technologies, as well as unforeseen threats and opportunities. Who's to say what might motivate or deter people from having children, or when and where they can even make the choice? But the nature of alarmism is to seize a fact and plow ahead.
You know, basically civilization will die with a whimper in adult diapers.
Then there is the tricky matter of how these trends are playing out. Because fertility rates are not falling at an equal rate around the world. Income, education, geography all play a large role. So a big part of the discussion here isn't just that we need more babies. It's about having enough of the right babies. Who is being encouraged to procreate and who is being targeted for birth control and family planning? And this is where the parallels to eugenics start to clang away.
Many of our friends, honestly, are very enthusiastic pronatalists. They have a lot of kids. They want other people to have a lot of kids. They're very pro-family, and they wish that we had a more pro-family culture that was more supportive to parents. But I would say that many people publicly are extremely against it, and we were surprised when we started engaging with people more publicly about our pronatalist advocacy, the kind of pushback that we get, like full-out hate all the way to death threats. So it was shocking to us because we think it's such a well-intentioned cause.
On their website, the Collinses offer matchmaking services. They've partnered with Keeper, a dating app that uses AI and IQ screening to solve the global marriage and fertility crisis. The couple also advocates for reproductive technology, like expanded access to in vitro fertilization.
We didn't do IVF because we were super bullish on doing IVF. We did IVF because I can't have kids naturally.
In 2018, Simone went through multiple rounds of IVF to collect and freeze as many embryos as possible. They called it the year of the harvest. In their sixth round of IVF, the couple used a company called Genomic Prediction. The company offers DNA tests that can help give prospective parents an opportunity to select embryos with a lower chance of diseases, such as diabetes, schizophrenia, and certain cancers. The company took a lot of heat. Some geneticists argued that its claims were irresponsible and that it's not possible to accurately predict disease risk in embryos. But the biggest controversy surrounded the company's practice of alerting prospective parents to embryos that it predicts will have an intellectual disability. At this point, they do not screen for IQ, though their co-founder, Steven Hsu, has said that pretty soon the tools will be there to reliably predict future intelligence. So the Collinses took this data and created a spreadsheet for their future offspring, accounting for the likelihood of certain diseases. With the help of yet another DNA analysis website, the Collinses looked at what they called mental performance adjacent traits, such as low mood, anxiety, stress, and ADHD. The tests also include a risk score for autism, which is a diagnosis Simone received as an adult. But they did not take this into account in their selection because they regard it as a potential asset. When I asked Malcolm whether he has any personal heroes, he promptly replied,
"Oh yeah, myself."
But he was quick to add a caveat.
Outside of myself, my wife, absolutely. She is somehow able to do things with a level of self-control that I genuinely can't even aspire to.
Malcolm and Simone believe they are creating the most optimal conditions for their kin. But these advancing screening possibilities have created all kinds of panic, with cries of designer babies and Gattaca children. Just in 2018, the Chinese scientist He Jiankui set off alarms and condemnation around the world with his announcement that he had created the first gene-edited babies, twin girls who he tried to make immune to HIV. All the same, a host of new companies are wading into pre-implantation screening and polygenic risk scoring, despite widespread concerns over ethics, efficacy, and how people will act on increasingly detailed information about their progeny. A survey conducted by Science suggests that as the technology becomes cheaper and more accurate, more people will use it. About 40% of respondents said if they were given a free test to determine which embryos would get into a top college, they'd be willing to take it. But Malcolm and Simone wave these worries aside. They've been called hipster eugenicists and drawn comparisons to The Handmaid's Tale. But they're unfazed by all of that, because their main priority is getting the word out.
The whole reason we're being public about this is because we want to ensure this message spreads broadly to people who think very differently from us, and people who are very different from us, so that they can also make it into the future.
Taking a page from internet trolling, Malcolm says the more negative press they receive, the better.
At the end of the day, the goal of our movement is to succeed, and unfortunately, the algorithms within a lot of these channels will really only boost you if you are saying things that sort of like a hook bait a fish and cause that fish to bite and swim with the hook, you know? And emotional charge causes engagement.
Sure, these ideas make great clickbait, but how do those same beliefs actually translate into raising children? That's after the break. Collins' pursuit of human optimization has echoes of transhumanism, but they insist that pronatalism charts a different path.
And when you say transhumanism, you can't just assume that everyone's meaning the same thing, because we're going to say we're super transhumanist because we're like, yeah, let's have cyborg kids who completely like CRISPR themselves into something totally different. And they're saying, yeah, we're super transhumanist. We're going to vitrify ourselves and then like come back to life later when technology is better.
By CRISPR, FYI, Simone is talking about gene editing technology. So far, experts around the world have called to limit its use when it comes to human embryos. If used, it could alter the human gene pool over generations. But for those advocating improvements to human biology, that could be a good thing.
There's a pretty big divide between the life extensionists and the pronatalists. And a lot of people can say, why would there be a beef there? And if you look at life extensionism from the perspective of pronatalism, like long-term life extensionism, not just like life quality improvement, I personally am the pinnacle of the human race. Whereas if you look at the belief of pronatalism, what it's really founded upon is the idea that even if you have the technology to live forever, it's still better to have kids. I know that my kids will update the worldview I pass down to them and the culture I pass down to them in ways I cannot even conceive.
Malcolm uses the language of updates when talking about subsequent generations. It makes me think less of people than of machines. But that's likely deliberate, as this future will be deeply informed by technology.
Obviously, we love the idea of using technology to become something different and better or to participate in the future. And we think that we're better off modifying our biology in a way that's really orthogonal to AI and then walking hand in hand into the future with AI.
Their values differ too, in that unlike the transhumanists we've spoken with, they don't believe the future will be all rosy and bright.
Man, all I say to people is buckle up. It's gonna get so much worse. My kids will inherit a worse world than the one that I live in right now. And my grandkids will likely inherit a worse world than my kids. Eventually, I think we'll be able to make things better. Eventually, I think we will stabilize things and create a genuinely aspirational future for our species. But in the short term, things will get harder. And that's the thing about the pronatalist movement. If we don't start it and build it into something serious now, while times are still good, it only gets harder from here.
I'm so curious where you derive your confidence that things are going to deteriorate for perhaps multiple generations and at some point things will turn around as opposed to just continue to like sail off a cliff.
We sort of see civilization as existing in cycles. You get the Athenians, right? And near the peak of their cycle, society becomes more open. But you also get a flourishing of culture. You get a flourishing of prosperity. And then everything falls apart. This is a cycle that we have gone through over and over again as a civilization. But hopefully we've learned from this cycle enough now that going into the next one, we can intentionally construct things to create a permanent renaissance, to create a peak of one of these cycles that doesn't necessarily lead to its own collapse.
So it's with that faith that Simone and Malcolm are raising their sons, Torsten and Octavian, and their daughter, Titan Invictus. And it's with that faith that they intend to have at least 4 more children.
And we would like to have between 7 and 13. 7 being what I think is a reasonable stretch goal, and 13 being more like what we would love to have.
As Malcolm pointed out, if they can have just 8 kids and then ensure that each of those kids has 8 more of their own over the course of 11 generations, there would be 8.6 billion sons and daughters of the Collinses tearing around the world. But they say that's not the goal.
We're not saying this because our plan is to replace everyone on Earth. That would actually be the highest failure scenario for us, because that's like a massive decrease in cultural diversity around the world.
Their ultimate aim, they say, is pluralism. But what does that mean? For the Collinses, from what I can tell, it's cultural diversity alongside wealth and high levels of educational attainment, which on some level sounds great. Who doesn't want that for the world? That is, until I start listening more closely to the fears that animate that desire. To hear it from Malcolm, it seems like the future will be a world of ruthless haves and have-nots.
Either we live in a world where you have prosperous areas with wide access to education and essentially use those other countries like breeding pens, or we spread these things all across the world, and then the world population just begins to shrink and eventually dies off.
More likely, he says, is that the groups within developed countries that remain outside the reach of wealth and education will keep having kids, and it will be their cultures that continue to take root. And eventually,
this prosperous urban monoculture that sort of exists around the world today disappears, and the future is controlled by what we call a sort of an ISISocracy. And by that, what we don't mean in an Islamic sense, every religious tradition, anywhere you look in the world, has some iteration of their practice, which is just like, you know, super misogynistic, super traditionalist, treats women terribly, and has really high fertility rates. And those are the people who it looks like today are going to inherit the future.
It's a charged and presumptive premise. And where it lands for Malcolm is back on the logic that the urban elites of the developed world need to have more children. But as I'm taking in this frantic vision of the world to come, what I'm really thinking about is migration and the extent to which these fears mirror the cultural hysterias that accompany any mass movement of people across borders. Because let's face it, migration is the flip side of the demographic coin. Look at the U.S. right now. The growth of the U.S. population is at an historic low, but immigration is making up a significant amount of that growth. So pluralism also strikes me as a code for privilege, an argument in favor of protecting certain cultures so they aren't overrun by others. Simone and Malcolm warn of cultural extinction, but it's a curious application of the idea. The preservation of cultural heritage is usually framed in reference to the threats of modernity and Western lifestyles. But here, it's wealth and learning and relative progressivism that are seen as under threat.
Success for pronatalism is a future human civilization that is even more diverse, both culturally and ethnically, than it is now, that is stable and thriving. Because if, for example, humanity is faced by some new existential threat that we've never even imagined, we're way better off if there are 17 different cultures trying to solve it than two.
One of the existential threats that I can think of is climate change. When asked about how this threat could challenge family planning, Simone quipped,
"I think that people's reference to climate change as a reason to not have children is just a just-so excuse. And climate change is also a virtue signaling excuse. You know, it makes you look good for not having kids because you are responsible, because you care about the environment." Ironically, we actually would argue that if you care about the environment, you should be having kids. And this goes to the well-attested, well-supported by research fact that sociological traits are heritable. Voting patterns, political affiliation, religiosity, a lot of different behaviors have significant heritable components, meaning that if people who care about the environment, who are conscientious about sustainability, all that sort of thing, do not have children, that kind of sociological profile is going to start disappearing from human populations. So if you really care about the environment, it would be wise to make sure that your culture and your sociological profile from a genetic standpoint doesn't delete itself from human civilization.
For the Collinses, the logic is all crystal clear. The rub is just getting others on board. So they've published a series of guidebooks on relationships, sex, and marriage. There's even one on crafting your own religion to train your children to carry on your life goals. After all, 11 generations is a long way out. Just think how much sex and gender and workforce participation and technology have changed between your generation and that of your parents.
Historically, if you wanted to spread your culture or your beliefs about the world, you had to go out and kill people, basically. And that's what's so cool, is now to win the cultural game, you can do it with love and social experimentation. And I say love and not sex, and love and not like spamming out kids, because if you just spam out kids, those kids are gonna be converted into this urban monoculture, just like, you know, everyone else. They're gonna breed like caged panda bears. You need your kids to like who they are, who their family is, and want to recreate that.
In the end, we know that not all of our children are going to want to have children, and we see raising them as essentially a sales pitch for our values and our worldview, and if we don't do a good job pitching, they're going to do whatever it is that they're going to do. So we aren't pressuring them to have kids or acting like they need to have kids, but we are trying to give them the most wonderful childhood they could ever imagine and show them how much fun that we have as parents. And we really do have a lot of fun. And to show them that a really meaningful way that you can serve society and make an impact in life is by having and raising kids.
And it used to be historically, you know, you could threaten your kids. You could say, oh, we'll expel you from our culture. Oh, you'll be punished forever if you don't stick with our value system. And the great thing about kids, you know, which we say in many ways makes kids better than, you know, life extension, is your kids can say, nah, I disagree. I've heard your pitch. I've heard it was a clear mind, and I think I can do better. And that's great. So what a great system we have where you now conquer the future through loving your kids and providing a good childhood for them that they voluntarily want to replicate.
And religions, of course, need holidays. Now that their kids are getting older, the Collinses have been creating new traditions.
So one of them is the New Year's holiday, which we have changed into Future Day. We frame our distant future descendants as like future police.
We kind of jokingly tell our children about the quote-unquote future police, who, if they do things that don't really serve the future of humanity, if they do things that are selfish, that are short-term oriented, that don't create a better future, the future police may come and punish them.
Every year, they explain, the future police take away some addictive piece of modern media, like their game consoles or smartphones.
So every year we have a holiday called Future Day, where something like an addictive game console or a mobile phone, access to a social media platform, is stolen from them by the future police.
Once their precious technology is stolen, the Collins kids have to find a way to convince the future police to get it back.
And they have to hide somewhere where plausibly the future police could find it thousands of years later, a pledge to work on something that year that would create a better future. And if they make that pledge, the thing that was stolen is returned along with a small gift. And if they achieve that goal they set out for the year, they get a larger gift later in the year from the future police. So it's kind of like our version of Santa Claus.
Simone and Malcolm insist that their vision of technophilic pronatalism is after something far more dynamic than transhumanism or life extension. But they also say that the changes taking place across science and society are coming so fast that we can't predict where they'll take us. And they want their children to evolve with the times.
Let's just look at like where we are in like 200 years, right? We're already to a point where we will have human level AI in 200 years. We're getting close to brain implanted chips. I would be almost certain we're going to be able to upload people into artificial environments, or at least simulacrums of people into artificial environments. That these environments, because they are artificial, would be able to give people literally everything they want. So, okay, we're like 200 years from creating like actual heavens in which people can live forever in paradise.
The future is bounding ahead, and yet this vision still strikes me as so static. A projection from the present that does not take into account the way that we humans will continue to change in response to the world around us. The Collinses clearly understand how the internet works and know how to walk the line between titillating and outrageous. These holidays they're inventing, it's all for children under the age of 4. It's hard to imagine anyone so young taking an oath to the distant future. But this is all kind of the point. They're basically living clickbait and are building a movement off of it. At the end of the day, they aren't alone in their ideology. They keep company with a number of wealthy, tech-leaning people fretting over how their kind are dying out. When I take it all in, it doesn't strike me as especially radical. Rather, it's an effort to uphold the status quo and preserve their privilege for future generations. And that, ultimately, is a tale as old as time. Coming next, we follow the future into a different direction. Next time, we meet journalist and philosopher Zoltan Istvan. Not long ago, he ran for president on the Transhumanist Party ticket. He believed he was going to live forever. And then along came ChatGPT.
Well, I gotta tell you, I do think the world is coming to an end, and I did not think that last time we spoke. And when I say an end, I don't mean that it's gonna be some kind of giant apocalypse, this and that. I just mean there's a very real chance in 10 years' time, or maybe 7 years' time, every single car on planet Earth will stop. And every single house could lose power. And all your water faucets could stop, because all this stuff is AI-based. A lot of humanity could end up back in the dark ages because AI has chosen to stop humanity as it would a virus.
Seeking is written and presented by me, Catherine Rowland. Maya Croth is the senior producer. Our producers are Rob Dozier, Erica Guida, and Tiffany Walker. This episode was edited by Grant Irving and Megan Dietry. Megan Dietry and Lizzie Jacobs are our executive producers. Fact-checking by Natsumi Ajisaka. Original music by Nolan Schneider. Mixing and music supervision by Sam Baer. Special thanks to Serena Chow.